I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barber shop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for our shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, political science professor Lester Spence, and syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete. I may jump in here or there, but for now, take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, yo, fellas, what's up? Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey,
what's up?
Doing good, man. Hey.
Hey, well, you know what? Pop music icon Michael Jackson was eulogized at a televised memorial watched by 31 million viewers in the U.S. alone. That was this week. Now, there were 6 million viewers in the U.K., 20 million in Germany, and 10 million in France. And in front of the stage was Michael Jackson himself. He was inside his $25,000 gold-plated casket that he picked out himself not long ago. He was inspired by the well, the Godfather of Soul, James Brown. It is the exact same model that James Brown was buried in. Do we have some tape?
Yeah, I mean, it was a 2.5-hour service, and there were many, many moments that we could pick. And I'm sort of conflicted because on the one hand, there were some fun, as you would imagine in a memorial service, there were some funny moments, some funny stories told, which we would all agree with. And then I think I have to say, I think the most emotional moment was when we heard from Michael Jackson's daughter. Unexpectedly, I would have to say, since he'd made such efforts to protect their identities over the course of his time with them. But here she decided to, I believe on her own, it seemed to be on her own, she decided she wanted to say something. And this is what she had to say.
I just wanted to say, ever since I was born, Daddy has been the best father you could ever imagine. And I just wanted to say I love him so much.
Wow. That never gets any easier to hear. I'm the father of a daughter, and I just I heard that, Michelle, I fell off the couch in tears. I couldn't believe it. It just really struck me. Thanks for that.
Did it change how you thought about him?
Not me personally. I guess my job as a culture critic, you know, I take pot shots at a lot of people, but I'd always known that he was he was a pop star, but he's also a father. But to hear his daughter just come down like that, it really tore me to pieces. Mm-hmm. Dr. Lester Spence, you know, how should we remember Michael Jackson? How is he best remembered?
It's funny because what stands out to me is Al Sharpton's speech. And although usually there are a lot of ways that Sharpton carries himself, a lot of his politics I don't agree with, I think that he hit the nail on the head. Michael Jackson was one of the most seminal figures as far as bringing black and white populations together, right? And I think that it's going to take some time because there's a moment right when he passes where he becomes larger than life and people want to ignore the more controversial aspects of his life. But I think in talking about what he contributed to the American fabric, that's how he's going to be remembered, and that's how he should be remembered. Not fully how he should be remembered, but that's the thing that stands out to me.
I hear that. You know, and this was Al Sharpton on message, on beat. Give him his props for his pastoral moment, for sure. A-Train.
Yeah, I mean, springboarding off of what Lester said, you know, another thing that I think cannot be underscored enough is the fact that not only did MJ bridge the divide between black and white here in this country, but he really was a transnational, transracial, transreligious figure who really captured our inner global zeitgeist, you know, from the Sultan of Brunei to the lowest slumdog millionaire anywhere in the world. Everyone had some sort of connection to Michael Jackson. And I think that, you know, I don't think that there's any person in modern history who can actually say that. And I think that that really is a testament to the effect that he's had on our global zeitgeist.
You know, his hometown of Gary, Indiana, they're holding a memorial today. The father, Joe Jackson, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson are expected to attend. You know, I think his legacy is it's kind of a story of tenacity because people forget that he had four solo albums that flopped before Off the Wall, and he dared to dream that he could be the greatest there ever was, and he hit it. The R.
Hey, you know, for me, it's been interesting to sort of think about how this has all impacted me. Michael Jackson has impacted me more in death than he did in life. Even though I was a fan, like a lot of people, you know, he had left my orbit. I'd gone on to other things, and I'd taken on other types of music that I liked. But really, the memorial service reminded me that he's had an impact on me since he's gone, because we've been able to get to this great paradox. This was somebody who was, as we know, very successful, but he was tormented. He was an unhappy figure at various times. But he was also somebody who nobody really knew. Nobody really knew Michael Jackson. Even Michael Jackson arguably didn't know Michael Jackson. And so you begin to see glimpses of it in this memorial service. That's why I'm with you, Jimmy. I mean, obviously, as the father of two little ones, a little boy and a little girl, I was bawling when I got to the part about his daughter, because it reminded us, no matter what else you say about this person, no matter how the public so unjustly ridiculed him and mocked him over the years, this was probably a very good father. And nobody can stand and say he wasn't a good father, because only his three kids can tell us what kind of father he was. And they vouched for him. They co-signed him, to use Jimmy's word. And that was really, I think, impactful. Lastly, the big tragedy of this story is, as we are about to find out, this was a guy who, enormously talented, had these leeches all around him who were trying to suck up all his money. And they included people who were prescribing these drugs, you know, people who wanted to take his money from him. And we have learned now, we're going to get into a long and uncomfortable discussion in this country about prescription drug abuse. But we've learned that rich people often have very poor health coverage, health care services, because they can get whatever they want, even stuff that can hurt them.
Oh, wow.
That's so true. It's such a good point. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and I'm speaking with Jimmy Israel, Arsalan Iftikhar, Ruben Navarrete, and Professor Lester Spence. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. You know, in other sad news, death of former NFL star Steve McNair and his girlfriend, Tahil Kassemi, has been ruled a murder-suicide by authorities in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, the married father leaves four boys to mourn his loss, and I'm sure I speak for all the boys in the shop to say that we'd like to extend our condolences to both families at this really tough time. Lester Spence, man, what's the deal? I mean, it's, you know, adultery, these past couple weeks, it's broken up marriages, it's separated kids from dads, and here it's taken two lives. Man, I don't know what you say about a story like this that just leaves two families in pieces.
So the way I think about this, as far as covering this in a manner that can lead to understanding and lead to better relationships, is to focus on the impact of economic stress on marriages, right? And on people in these relationships. So it's clear. So Steve McNair was a multimillionaire, but the woman he was involved with had a significant amount of economic stress in her life. At least that's what the police are saying. And then when she found out that he was not going to leave his wife and that he was seeing someone else, she felt she felt that all the plans that she had in front of her were like dashed, right? So she kills him, tries to arrange the death in a way that she lays on him and is unable to do that. I mean, so what you focus on in this story is the economic stress that causes her in that moment to think that she has nothing left.
You know, that makes sense to me. But I tell you what occurs to me, too, is part of what this is about is the loss of fame on McNair's part. I have to wonder, what was McNair thinking? And I have to wonder, what was it? And there's all kinds of jokes that obviously one is tempted to make about this. But that it's more that, you know, these guys, they're so famous, so young.
No, that's
and
right.
then when they lose that.
Yes.
And your life as a professional athlete lasts a very short time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of trying to regain that, the thrill of being the focus of so much attention. And I obviously people are responsible for their own behavior, but it makes me wonder whether isn't there something that these leagues could do to help these guys transition better out of that lifestyle.
That's so excellent.
Actually, Michelle brings up a good point. Eddie George, who was a former Tennessee Titan running back and teammate of Steve McNair, said that, you know, after he retired, he didn't really know what to do with himself anymore. I mean, you know, this was a guy who was a star quarterback at Alcorn State, a Division I AA school, and was one of the first Division I AA people to be considered for the Heisman Trophy, which eventually went to Rashawn Salaam. You know, but again, at the end of the day, these guys are multimillionaires. You know, they have no need for want, and so
you guys are reaching.
What I'm saying is, I don't buy the fact that, you know, this multimillionaire, needed to have some sort of counseling in order to you know, make that transition. I think
here's what we have. This is Ruben. I'm sorry.
Ruben, I'm sorry. I just want to clarify that the report suggests that McNair was seeing somebody else, and the mistress apparently believed that he was. So I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's
Thank
confirmed.
You.
I just wanted to clarify that. Go ahead, Ruben.
Yeah. I'm sure people all over America are thinking, you know, the fact that she found out he wasn't going to leave his wife. Hello, they never leave their wives. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, she convinced herself this was going to happen. So far, we've had these theories that he couldn't transition out of, you know, fame to nobody status, that it was economic stress on her and whatever. At the bottom line is this happens to members of Congress, to senators, to governors, to presidential candidates because of weakness, because of temptation, and because all men feel that temptation, and because all men have to learn how to overcome that temptation. Why is it that somehow because he's a football player or because he's a senator or a congressman or a governor, we bend over backward to try to figure it out and put it in context, but when it's any one of the guys in the shop, you know, that falls off and suddenly cheats on his wife, then we don't have that excuse. This is about basic weakness and about basic, you know, giving into temptation. The lesson here, it's almost kind of a fatal attraction thing because men are drawn to women on a very physical level, you know, but you don't know what's in there. You don't know what's in that head. You don't know how she's, you know, how functional is this person? And obviously he picked the wrong person. And there's
right.
there's a moral lesson in there. I know women all over America are saying, you know what? I'm going to get around to mourning McNair later, okay? Because this is a guy
you.
Who brought this onto himself.
No, he certainly did. But
absolutely.
I do think,
yeah,
I just do think
that.
This whole culture of celebrity thing, I just think there's something
think
about these people's lives that is just different. I mean, this whole thing of walking down the street and have everybody want to, like, look at you and touch you. You go to Dave and Buster's, and everybody's, like, in your face, wants your autograph, and you're, like, 22.
So he found this woman
and
said, touch me, look at me.
Yeah, I'm not excusing his behavior, but I just think that there's something about being a celebrity at such a young age in this country that can be overwhelming and can just mess up your judgment. That's all I'm saying.
You know what, Michelle? This is really just kind of a tragic situation for everybody involved. And again, you know, I think we should extend our condolences. You know what? But let's look forward and look ahead to the NAACP convention. You know, it's always a good time to talk about what the future holds for the civil rights organization, civil rights groups in general. Now, the NAACP kicks off its week-long centennial celebration tomorrow in New York City. We got some tape of Ben Jealous. Is that right?
No. I think we're just going to go into the conversation. And Arsalan, I guess I'm particularly interested in what you have to say because you did work in a civil rights organization yourself. You're not at the moment. You're working, you know, as a writer and a commentator and so forth. But I'm curious to know what you think in this new age, in the Obama age, what role an organization like the NAACP has.
I think it continues to play a very important role. I think that all civil rights organizations, whether they're based on racial or ethnic origin or religion, I think are extremely important. And I think that, you know, what we saw this week when, you know, the Valley Swim Club in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania, you know, kicked out 60 young African-American kids who just went to the swimming pool to swim. And so, you know, they obviously for which they had paid. So, I mean,
I think that's a bad example.
Well, no, the Valley Swim Club gets the Redonkulous Award this week. I think it's going to be a major civil rights lawsuit. And I think that we're going to continue to see major civil rights legislation, you know, past the administration of Barack Obama.
You know, A-Train, not to get too off on that particular incident, but I wonder if that's more like a clash of cultures than it is like a class of culture. I mean, class of colors. You know what I mean? Because I wonder if some young white kids from the same economic strata had come to this hoity-toity private club, and you know, I think it's a culture shock that's involved here. And I think color complicates it, but I think there's a culture shock that has play there. You know, but you know, as involved in NAACP, they're involved with that. You know, and this might be a time. Yeah, I mean, I agree that you know that they need to look into that, but I think the organization has had some challenges being relevant. And I like what Ben Jealous has said recently about the organization focusing on education and criminal injustice. And that's what this organization, that's what the NAACP has needed for years, focus. You know, you can't just chase every fire, and you have to be more relevant than just boycotting the N-word every 5 or 6 years.
Lester, what do you think? Wait, Lester, what do you think?
I think the NAACP has two challenges going forward besides the economic crisis. One is their executive board is still too bloated and it skews way too old. The second is that individual chapters don't necessarily have the freedom to pursue the goals that they're interested in pursuing, which makes it really difficult for them to speak to local constituencies. I think that Ben Jealous can talk, and it's good that he's there. Makes me feel kind of old that he's younger than me. But it's good that he's there. You know, he's saying the right things, but those are structural issues that having the right guy in aren't going to that having the right guy in there won't do much.
Ruben, we only have about a minute. What, you want to weigh in?
Well, very quickly. One of the best things the NAACP has done recently is that when it came out in favor of No Child Left Behind, because it said even though it was proposed by a Republican president, it really does help black and brown kids by raising expectations and standards. And so if it gets beyond sort of the ideological bounds that sometimes it gets wrapped up in, I think that's great. But, you know, the lesson of the swimming pool story is that this is the best of times. This is the Dickens era for black folks. This is the best of times and the worst of times. You have a black president, but you also have a resurgence of racism because people aren't ready for that. So I think this is a really critical time for the NAACP to do a better job than it has in terms of making this a promise a reality.
So. All right. Well, back to you, Michelle.
All right. Thank you, Al. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com and TV One Online. He joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Ruben Navarrete writes for the San Diego Union-Tribune and CNN.com, and he joined us from San Diego. Lester Spence is a political science professor at Johns Hopkins University, and Arsalan Iftikhar is the founder of TheMuslimGuide.com and a civil rights attorney and an author. And they were both kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington. Gentlemen, I thank you all.
Peace.
Thanks.
Yep, yep.